Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces to WFIU listeners interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and the world. I'm Owen Johnson. Our guest on this occasion is Sylvia Nasser, an author and former New York Times reporter, best known for her book, A Beautiful Mind, and the subsequent movie of the same name. Sylvia, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Your story begins, I guess, with parents who at first glance would seem like an unlikely couple. Is there a story there?
Well, there is. My father is from a part of the world that most Americans never heard of until rather recently, namely former Soviet Central Asia. And he met my mother at the end of World War II in Bavaria. She was 19 years old, the daughter of a judge who lived in a little village. And the reason that they met is that my father, who was drafted into the Red Army at the beginning of the war, one of about 10,000 Muslims who were, deserted early in the war and joined the Germans. And when Germany was collapsing, he, being a very enterprising, clever 23-year-old, contrived to be not in Berlin or the East, but in northern Italy, near southern Germany. So he survived, and he was not handed over to the Russians, and he was extremely good-looking, looked like an American Indian, very, very slender, very handsome, and it was love at first sight.
It's a great story. And then they came to the United States.
They did. My mother's family was unusual in that they were Bavarian Catholics. My grandfather was a judge and probably one of the few people in their town who had a genuine interest in foreign countries. He used to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning both to dig potatoes and to study Chinese. I don't know if you ever went to China. And while, you know, any other family would have totally rejected the idea of their youngest daughter marrying an Asian, my grandfather really embraced my father. And they did get married, and I was born a year later. And then, in another sort of stroke of luck but also history, my father met Teddy Roosevelt's grandson, Archibald Roosevelt, who was on his way through Munich to set up a CIA station in Iraq. And he stopped, met my father, and suggested that maybe he should come to the United States because no one at that time in the United States, it was the beginning of the Cold War, really had any conception that most of the Soviet Union was full of minorities, including a huge Muslim minority, who hated the Russians and considered themselves, you know, captive nations. So Archibald Roosevelt suggested to my father that maybe come to the U.S. and work for Voice of America. But, of course, there was no immigration quota for any citizen of, former citizen of, the Asian part of the Soviet Union. The quota was zero, which my father pointed out. And Archibald said, well, you know, CIA, the State Department, we might be able to do something. So that's how we got to Forest Hills, Queens in 1951.
What do you remember about growing up in the States? Because you were here, what, 8 or 9 years at that point?
Well, I was four. I remember everything. I remember the American troop ship that we came over on. It was horrible. I remember the medical examination, you know, in a room with like 1,000 other people. And most of all, I remember the very glamorous apartment house in Rego Park that we moved to. And, you know, for us, America was, you know, it was like stepping onto a Hollywood set. And now looking back at the photographs, of course, my mother was beautiful and those 50s clothes. And I, of course, was always wearing, you know, big sunglasses and It was incredible. I mean, none of us, you know, we just felt like this was the most amazing experience that anyone could have on the planet. And my mother was thrilled to be leaving the old country and the old ways. And my father was excited to be anywhere where he could work. And it was a very strange but really wonderful experience. I, of course, learned English practically overnight. It was a little traumatic because, I mean, I remember my first day of kindergarten, you know, a lot of the other children were pointing at me and saying, "Chinese, Chinese," because, of course, I had a very round face and black hair and bangs. And I didn't really speak English then, but by a few months of kindergarten and this daily torment, my English was pretty good. My father, who speaks about 10 languages, speaks none of them sort of in a conventional sense. You know, he kind of mixes them all together. My mother speaks very perfect and beautiful English, but heavily accented, even though she was only in her mid-20s.
Did you speak their languages with them at all?
Well, we spoke German at home. Okay, my father, having been in the Wehrmacht, was fluent. Well, I mean, again, he spoke German with a mixture of Russian, Turkish. He always mixed languages like that. But we always spoke German at home, and I still speak German with my parents. Unfortunately, they're the only people that I speak German with regularly. So I have to go back there for a semester or two to revive my vocabulary.
Was it traumatic for you when you moved to Turkey then, about the time you were becoming a teenager?
No. You know, it's funny because I was talking with some friends who were staying in the suburban town where we live, and I was wondering, well, why are you staying? Well, it turned out they had a 14-year-old son. I mean, when I was growing up, people loved to move. My mother literally loved nothing better than breaking up a household and setting up a new one. And I felt the same way. I always thought that I would be in the State Department, something that would force me to move every couple of years. Of course, I've gone nowhere, moved hardly at all my whole adult life. But it was a great experience. You could always start over again. That was one benefit. But also, we were so interested in all the new things.
What are your memories of the time that you spent in Turkey? It was, what, 3-4 years?
Well, it was actually my parents were there for 10. I was there all of high school. So that was 1960. I went to a military high school that gradually pulled both diplomatic and military kids from all over the Middle East. And, you know, it was a very sort of mixed experience in the sense that that was a very parochial time. I mean, everything in America was parochial. The fact that nobody, really the whole entire time I was growing up, nobody had ever heard of Turkestan, Uzbekistan. It was just very provincial. Okay, so the American community in Turkey was also like that. Being teenagers, we were much more interested in what was happening at our school, ordering clothes from the Sears catalog, what people did when they went on home leave, than we were in Turkey. And I, for example, did not become fluent in Turkish. I, in fact, did not. Well, look, if you're a teenage girl, living in Turkey was not that great in the sense that you were always being followed, harassed, fond. You know, it was very constricting, okay? I'm sure that I would feel very, very differently now. But it was also, even as sort of self-involved and stupid as we were, you know, we did have some realization of how amazing it was to, say, be studying Greek mythology in the neighborhood of Troy. Or when we went to our senior class trip was to Rhodes. Okay, so, you know, being aware of all these civilizations and all this history right there. And, you know, the Turks are, like many nationalities, Americans accepted, are really into their history. Okay, I mean, that's just, you know, as were my parents, who always told, I mean, a lot of family conversation was not about current events. It was about telling family stories. So you're always aware of this amazing history and how it intersected with the culture that you took for granted. So, you know, I appreciated and then I didn't appreciate and kind of went back and forth.
Your high school then was somewhat traditional and you wind up going to what I guess one would call a very untraditional college.
Antioch, which unfortunately no longer exists. It had one of those 1960s meltdowns when the usual rules of college finance and prudence were abandoned. Anyway, you know, the CIA, where my father was working, was a much more diverse institution than many people realize. And someone who had a big influence on me, particularly because my parents, being immigrants, really couldn't have much input in terms of what I studied or what college I went to, was a woman who was a case officer, CIA. She lived across the street from us in a penthouse, and she was a left-wing Democrat. Her father had been an artist. She was a graduate of the University of Chicago. And the people she chose to hang out with, and this was when I was a junior in high school, were Peace Corps volunteers. So she was completely different from, you know, what one would imagine CIA people would do. And she's the one who pointed out Antioch and similar schools, because I would have not had any way to get that kind of information. I mean, it's true that one other person from my senior class also applied to Antioch, but he came from a more, you know, a family where you would expect people to know about great little liberal arts colleges. So,
how did you happen to choose literature as a major?
Yes, my father always asked himself that. And he used to introduce me as a journalism major to his friends because there was no way to explain why someone was getting this incredibly expensive education, because Antioch had no endowment and, you know, this incredibly tuition that rivaled Harvard's, and doing something that had obviously no practical application. I mean, first of all, when Mary, my older woman friend, asked me what I intended to do with my life at one point, I said, well, I think I'll marry a rich man who will let me sit around and read novels all day. Of course, I'd never met a rich man, but I did spend a lot of my time reading, and it was the only thing I really liked to do. I was a terrible student. You know, I barely had a C average when I graduated because I really hated everything except reading. So Antioch seemed to be the kind of place where you could do what you wanted, which is why I was there. My father really disapproved of it, which made it even better. And look, my generation, okay, and this is, you know, later when I studied economics and then looked at all this data, my generation was the last generation that had no plans for the future. Okay, I'm talking about women. All right, we went to college with the expectation that we would work for a few years at something or other, and then there was a kind of a blank after that. So we chose majors based on what interested us, or, you know, or the pink collar profession that we were going to go into. Now, of course, like at Columbia, the women have the same profile in terms of choice of the most popular major is economics. Why? Because now women expect to work most of their lives, or at least, you know, whether or not they have children and stay home with those children, they expect to have a career. So their choices are not based on what they intend to do with their free time, but rather in what kind of work they intend to do or what kind of training they think will serve them the best. So it was a very personal but at the same time sort of a choice that reflected where my generation was, that's all.
You had a few years before you started graduate school, after your undergraduate days. What did you do with those few years?
Well, I started graduate school, then I dropped out. Then I wanted to be in New York. So then I drifted in. Look, everything was kind of accidental. I mean, that's what's so different about my generation versus, for example, the lovely young people I met with today, many of whom were women. It was just, well, I guess I'll do this. I guess I'll do that. One thing led to another, and that's where you went. So I wound up working for the city government. That's who happened to be – it was a recession. That's who happened to be hiring, monitoring drug addiction programs. So that's what I did. But, you know, the fact is that especially when you're young, you learn from whatever experiences you have, no matter how stupid, no matter how sort of unrelated to any master plan, somehow you extract things from it. So eventually I thought, well, maybe I should go to graduate school. And it was still – it was the end of the Vietnam era and, you know, a lot of people my age in New York were, you know, sort of interested in Marxism. And I thought, well, okay, economics. I mean, this is how I made decisions. What can I say? Very, very different. And, you know, it must seem very quaint to younger people.
Yeah, I was about to ask how it was that you got to economics. Because that's
accidentally
the dismal science.
Yes, glamorized. I mean, the only people who thought it was really glamorous, and because they were such horrible economic determinists and didn't really know that much about economics either, were lefties. So then, of course, graduate school was a horrible shock. It was nothing like I expected.
You seem to have gone in two directions once you got into the graduate school. On the one hand, you finished a master's degree, didn't go on to the doctorate.
I started out to do a doctorate, and I was crippled by the fact that I had no mathematics, okay? I mean, I had to do remedial math at Antioch, so you can imagine how crippled I was. And even in 1973, even at, you know, NYU was not the first-rate program it is today, even then you had to be mathematically literate. So for me, I mean, the great thing was, of course, that that's where I learned about the Nash equilibrium in about the first week of Math for Economists, which I had to, you know, if you have to take Math for Economists in graduate school, you probably shouldn't be in a graduate economics program, but there I was.
And yet you worked for, what, 4 years for Vasily Leontief, a well-known economist? You must have some talent in those areas.
Well, I had a talent for making friends and – when Leontief – I mean, NYU was an interesting place because back then it was quite undistinguished, although it had, you know, some brilliant people in mathematics, et cetera. But they had a brilliant strategy, which is at a time when all the Ivy Leagues had a mandatory requirement – this is before the Supreme Court struck it down – NYU decided to hire all these people who had been pushed out of – the three best economics departments in the world, namely Princeton, Harvard, and MIT. So all these, what we thought of then as geriatric professors, came to NYU, and it turned out that they still had a lot of good years. Okay, I mean, Leontief was still a university professor teaching his seminar when he died at 95. Okay, Will Baumol, who is my introductory micro teacher and is, you know, one of the great people in the field, is still teaching at NYU now. So anyway, and that is what created the little tipping point that sent NYU on the road to becoming a really world-class department. But it would have been without me because even in those days, I just could not. The math was – it was too big a handicap. And, you know, if I'd been more confident, I might have been able to master it. I might have taken the time. But, of course, when you're that age, you think that every failure reflects some basic deficiency in you and that it's a sign that you made the wrong choice. And, again, I didn't know a lot of people who could have said otherwise. But, you know, at the end of the day, it all worked out.
before we get to the end of the day.
Right.
Yeah. In 1983, you joined Fortune magazine. Did you seek that out, or did they discover you, or was it pure accident somehow?
Well, it was another accident. This is what, as I was telling the journalism students I met at lunch, I have been feeling that my experience in journalism is completely irrelevant to my students, people who are going in now. And I've recently realized, oh, that's not the case, because the 82 recession was the worst since the Great Depression. Everyone was convinced that America was on its, way down, and all kinds of seemingly intelligent people were writing that the next generation isn't going to live as well as we. And it was all kind of hopeless. Well, that's when I got into journalism, and I got in because I was fired by the computer company, which I'm happy to say went out of business long before I did, who had acquired a database company that was trying to use some of Leontief's models. I had a job. By this time, I had two young children, and they fired me because, as the guy who fired me told me, that I couldn't write. And I was so happy because by the time my coworkers gave me a going away party, I'd been hired as a staff writer at Fortune. Now, I would never have done that if I hadn't been fired, because Fortune was going to pay me $35,000, which was not a very high salary for somebody who had to support two children. But I didn't have any other choices. So that's what I did on this very slender read of this master's degree. And I had not been a very good student either. But it turned out to be a great thing for me, because as soon as I got there, I realized, oh, my God, this is so much fun. And it was so challenging, because imagine, I didn't know too much economics. And certainly none of the economics that you need to write about the actual economy, since what you're doing in graduate school is learning theory. And I'd also never written anything for publication. So it was a drama. Every deadline was a real drama. Now, it was also a reflection of the times, because Fortune had an economics column. It was 1,500 words a month. Then it became every 2 weeks. So they had a chief economist, a deputy. They were writers. Then they hired the man who reached out to me, a PhD. So there were three of them. And I said, so why do you need someone else? They really felt overworked. Okay.
To do these 1,500 words?
Yeah. Now, it's true. They produced a forecast. They were doing real data analysis. And by the way, there were no computers. They had large green sheets. Every time the government revised some lousy monthly retail sales figure, a researcher had to go through and change all those numbers. Anyway, while that recession was disastrous for construction and manufacturing, it was fat and happy days in journalism, especially these sort of old line monopolies. It wasn't just the staff. It was the town cars, the expense accounts, et cetera. Otherwise, I don't know who ever would have hired me, but it was a toehold. And because of that, their uncost-conscious way of managing their businesses, it was like going to university, but a university of journalism. Your stories were edited by wonderful writers who spent lavished attention on someone who didn't know too much and certainly didn't know how to write. I mean, I remember when Bill Rukeyser complimented me on an inventory piece, 800 words. Why? Because I'd actually called up some CEOs and had some quotes in it. Okay? Well, it was a great education.
Let's pause here now for some music, and I'll ask you to tell us what you'd like to hear.
Well, I'd love to hear the first song on the Mark Knopfler and Emmy Lou Harris album.
has been spoken. There's not a lot to see, but something has been broken. That's how it feels to me.
We had a harmony. I never meant to spoil. Now it's lying in the water.
That was music from the album by Mark Knopfler and Emmylou Harris, chosen by our guest on Profiles today, the writer and journalist Sylvia Nasser. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com.
Sylvia, when people hear your name, most of them, I think of A Beautiful Mind. After all, it won a National Book Critics Circle Award and was a Pulitzer finalist. It's been translated into 30 languages. What inspired you to do the study of John Forbes Nash?
Well, I was an economics reporter at the Times. And by the way, mostly I wrote about the real economy, and a lot of my stories were based on data. And one day I was interviewing somebody at Princeton who had just been to Stockholm. So we were gossiping about who could be on the short list for the Nobel Prize. And he said, well, there's this crazy mathematician who hangs around the math building here at Princeton, and he might be on the short list. So I asked who that might be, because I'd never heard such a thing. And he said, John Nash. And I said, you don't mean the Nash of the Nash equilibrium? One of the few things that I retained from my mathematics training, such as it was. And that was indeed who it was. And then that made me interested enough to make a few phone calls. And I learned from a mathematician the basic story that Nash had never been an economist, that he had been one of the most brilliant mathematicians in the 50s, that he had been diagnosed with schizophrenia at age 30 and had been living with his ex-wife for all these years. And, you know, now there was this possibility of getting a Nobel for something that was really his juvenilia, even though it's a very, very big deal in economics, something that he had done as his PhD thesis. And I also learned that he seemed to have recovered from schizophrenia. So when I got off the phone, I thought, oh, my, this is the most amazing story I've ever heard. This is, you know, a story with a third act. You know, it's like a fairy tale or a Greek myth or a Shakespeare play. I mean, it just seemed just incredible. And what made it seem so incredible is that he was this intellectual giant. Okay, I mean, he was really one of these totemic, iconic figures personal features in, you know, for anyone who does economics, right up there with von Neumann or – and you never think of a person like that still being around, much less having a story. So then I decided, however – first I thought, well, I'll write the story now. Then I thought, and someone at Princeton – convinced me that it would be an invasion of privacy because, look, many, many more people are potential Nobel Prize winners than actually get a prize. And it just seemed like an invasion of privacy. I mean, people in Princeton read the New York Times. Anyway, so I let it be. And then he didn't win that year. Bob Fogel won. And a year later, when I wasn't thinking about it and I wasn't the reporter assigned to cover the daily Nobel story, I sat down at my desk, as I usually did. And in those days, we had the wires come up on whatever our something terminals. And there was the Nobel, you know, the economics Nobel, and there was Nash. And I thought, oh, my God, this is really amazing. So I went over to the editor I was most friendly with, the Sunday Business editor, and I started excitedly telling him the story. And Glenn's face turned bright red, and he got tears in his eyes, which I later found out he often cries. But I thought, now I'm going to do this story. Okay. So then I got a call from Princeton saying, thank you for your forbearance. You know, it was really – we really admire you for not having done the story. We just want to thank you. And we don't want you to do the story now either. You have to wait until after the Nobel ceremony in December. And I said, well, actually, no. Now he's got the mantle of the Nobel Prize. Nothing can really hurt him or look discreditable. So they said, well, that's fine. We are not going to cooperate. So fortunately, I had become friends with an Indiana native and graduate of DePauw and great journalist named Doug France. And we had been working together on investigative stories. So Doug sat opposite me because I was an economic trends person. I didn't really know that much about reporting. So I found out, not through any of the Princeton people, but almost by accident, that Nash had a sister. And after talking to all these economists and mathematicians, none of whom would put anything on the record because very legitimately they did not want, you know, this very happy moment to be tarnished by this embarrassing revelation about mental illness. After all of them had refused to put anything on the record, I found the sister, and thank God Doug was sitting across from me, because as soon as I got on the phone with her, he said, tell her you'll be on a plane and you'll be down there tomorrow, which is what I did. And Martha Nash, who is a very lovely, lovely woman, and who had made a decision that she was going to break what was a 25-year silence on the subject, she put it on the record. So I got the story, and it was an amazing story to work on because it was so his recovery, Alicia's role.
That's his wife.
The whole thing was so, you know, it was so touching and so dramatic, and it was full of so many sort of legendary characters. It was just a wonderful story to work on.
When did you decide to go from an article or a couple of articles to a book?
It was one article. It appeared in the Sunday Business section. It was on the front. And, well, when I came into work, you know, that next Monday, or maybe I took off a day or something, you know, the phones were ringing off the hook. And the response was incredible, okay? First of all, there were people who had known, you know, economists and mathematicians who had known Nash, but didn't know, of course, nobody knew the whole story. It's always the journalist who winds up with the most complete picture. Why? Because, you know, that's what we do. There were also people who had siblings or children with schizophrenia, and that probably was the nerve that this story really struck, that here was an illness that you never read about unless someone had pushed someone under a subway train or, you know, had just murdered his family. And everyone believed that it was a life sentence, that you could never recover from it. And here was somebody who had been one of the greatest mathematicians of the century, who had done all these incredible things and who had fallen so far and who came back. And that was really something that all these people who could never explain to their friends what was wrong with their child or their brother, now there was a story out there that could be referred to and that had a hopeful ending. So anyway, so there was this huge response. And so I thought, well, maybe I should. And a lot of people saying, well, this has to be a book. So I wasn't that interested in doing a book, but I thought maybe I should look into this. So I spent about 5 months working on a book proposal. And I wasn't going to do it if it didn't pay because I had, you know, three kids, two of whom were going to be soon going to college. And by the way, in contrast to many journalists, I don't think writing a book is the be-all and end-all because it doesn't matter if you're on TV or you're on the internet or you're on the front page of the New York Times. Having your work read and responded to by a lot of people and getting to go from one story to the other, I would say is the most amazing experience. And most stories, okay, have a much bigger impact than most books. So I felt like it had to offer something more than, you know, than my job at the New York Times. And anyway, it did. And so I took off 2.5 years from the paper. And that was also a wonderful experience. You know, it's always wonderful to do things that you've never done before. and I see you nodding. But it is wonderful not to plan things and to dive into things just because you happen to be at the right place at the right time and to kind of almost drown and then to discover that you can swim because it's very thrilling. So,
did you find it in any way emotionally draining because of the type of story it was?
It was extremely anxiety-provoking in every way because, you know, I didn't really think about it until the book was sold, okay? And it was sold for what was then a lot of money. And then I thought, oh, my God, he's not going to cooperate. And, of course, he did not cooperate. So that was one huge worry, that I wouldn't be able to get the story because Nash, I wouldn't ever be able to get to Nash. So in one sense, my worst fears were realized I was never able to get to Nash. However, thanks to the Times story, which was very well received, people thought it was respectful and everyone else talked to me. So it was possible to do the book. That was my biggest worry. My second, you know, I mean, I just remember waking up every single night terrified that I would not be able to get the story, find out what he – because remember, this was not someone like Paul Samuelson or Milton Friedman who were in the academy all those years. He had left academia in 1959. There was no paper trail. Nobody, even the Nobel Prize Committee, had to ask Harold Kuhn at Princeton to put together, you know, a half-page CV to even figure out where he was born, where he went to school, what his jobs were, and what he had published. There was no paper trail. So that was one big worry. The other big worry, which was almost as big and which grew over time instead of diminishing, was the fear that the book would make him sick. And see, I didn't know anything about schizophrenia either. And I thought it was possible that all this attention, you know, would cause him to relapse. And the third thing, I guess, I was also worried, as any writer who works on an unauthorized biography of a living subject, if they're not worrying about it, they're crazy, is I was worried about being sued, okay? I was worried about libel, but especially about invasion of privacy. So the whole thing was very anxiety-provoking. Just to give you an example, if there are any biographers out there listening, because I was talking about this recently, I introduced the biographer of Flannery O'Connor at a reading recently, and I just remember what his big anxiety was and how I got into a conversation with him in the first place, which was over the quotation of letters. So over time, people, it turned out, had saved letters that Nash had written. Some before he was sick, many after he was sick, and also students had written down the blackboard messages that he had written on the blackboards of the math building at Princeton. And there was a case involving J.D. Salinger, a very famous case that every biographer knows by heart, in which his biographer was not allowed to quote from letters, even though the letters were given to the biographer by their recipients, because guess what? The author of the letters has the rights. And I thought, oh my, because the only voice, the only way I could give Nash, the young Nash, who was really the central character of the book, not the, you know, not the current day, but the young one, that he could speak was by quoting these letters. Thank God there was, there's fair use. But I mean, all those things just about made me sick, because it was, you know, it was terrifying. And of course, everything, none of those terrible things happened, and it all ended happily.
And, well, one of the parts that came from it, of course, was that the book was made into a movie. I wonder, does that feel like giving up your child to somebody else and not knowing what's going to become of it?
Well, I think that, you know, some writers do feel that way, which I think is not a very wise attitude. By the time Ron Howard decided to do it, I had come to a different place, which is, I mean, it may seem like a very elementary realization, but, you know, it took me a while to sort of think my way to that place. Namely, I realized, wait a minute, this is a story that can be told many ways, because all great stories can be told many ways. And I've told it the way I, a newspaper reporter, would tell the story. My book is always, you know, it's done. It's always going to be there. And all I can hope is that whoever tells the story in some different way, is a documentary, is a feature film, whatever, is a novel, all I care about really is that they do a good job, because then that will make us all feel good. And, you know, of course, it was very lucky. Look, again, most movies sink like stones, okay? And not because there aren't incredibly talented people, just because it's very, very hard. A lot of things have to work. And most of the time, a lot of things don't work. And in this case, everything that could have gone – it was like an inversion of Murphy's Law. Everything that could have gone right went right. I mean, first of all, most important, somebody had an idea of how to turn what was really a linear and very densely detailed linear narrative, i.e. a journalistic narrative, into a movie, namely the idea of having the audience see the world through Nash's eyes in the first half of the movie and then yanking the rug out from under them, which is not just a great dramatic device which pulls the audience in, you know, and zillions of movies are structured that way, but it was the only one that could have conveyed the experience of someone who couldn't distinguish between reality and delusion and give the audience the emotional experience of what – a little bit of what that might feel like. So that was brilliant. You know, having Ron Howard, who is such a wonderful storyteller, and Russell Crowe, who can completely disappear into a character and who, you know, has an amazingly high IQ and therefore can very credibly portray someone like Nash and is also eccentric. I thought, oh, my God. And then, you know, it just – everything about it just worked. And, you know, by then I knew – I had enough sense to realize this is very, very rare and let me enjoy it, you know. Let me enjoy it. It's not my thing. I don't have to worry about it. I can just enjoy it and hope for the best. So that's what happened.
One last question I want to ask. You're working on a book on 20th century American economists. What do you hope to accomplish with that book?
I hope at in one of the rare moments in which readers, people who love books, who love to read, are interested in economics, I hope to, by telling the story of how our understanding of the economy and modern society came to be, you know, driven mainly by events like the ones we're living in now that pulled people who might have done something else, who might have been mathematicians or physicists or run railroads or whatever, but pulled them into the construction of a kind of a mental mechanism for discovering economic truths, you know, not a dogma, but a real means of discovering the truth. And, of course, once you know something, then for reasons that are political and ethical, you cannot use it. I mean, economics is a little bit like medicine in the sense that it's even more connected to history and society than other sciences, okay? Right now, economics is going to attract a lot more brilliant young people because something so unexpected, namely that an economy as sophisticated as the United States appears to be vulnerable to financial crises of the kind that, you know, before Japan's, we used to think only happened to either bad economies or emerging economies, could hit the United States. So all the whole history has been like that. You know, so the book starts in 1848 with the 23-year-old Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels coming to London during a financial crash, blah, blah, blah. And it follows about 12 characters who are drawn in not because, you know, they were wake up and say, oh, I want to be an economist, but because things were happening that were either so arresting intellectually or so compelling politically that they wanted to be where the action was, okay? And in the latter half of the 19th century, which was the first time that people were hopeful enough to consider poverty a social problem as opposed to just man's fate, because that was the first time that living standards actually were rising and continued to rise for the first time in history, then all these things that were attributed to human nature, to the world order, now became things that one might want to do something about, starting with poverty, which was universal. Then, by the 1920s, people actually aspired to ameliorate the insecurity and instability, the periodic instability of very successful economies. It's another story about – it's about overcoming and discovering, and it's taken a little bit longer than the Nash book because this time I don't have the – you know, his story, his life had a structure that – it wasn't obvious to everyone, of course, so I'm not minimizing that, but – it was a pretty dramatic structure, whereas in history you have to create that yourself. And you're a biographer. You know what I'm talking about, yes? But I feel, again, very lucky that I'm finishing it right at this moment because I think it's going to be very different as a result of hearing the same debates going on today that were happening in the 1930s, in the 1970s. Anyway, I enjoyed our conversation.
So have I, and we'll look forward to the book. Our guest today has been writer, reporter, and teacher Sylvia Nasser. Sylvia, thanks very much for visiting with us. To our listeners, we're pleased you joined us, and we close with music by Renee Fleming. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
The program you have just heard was recorded in April of 2009. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.